And we are going to have a different type of show. We spend a lot of time on foreign affairs here, but in this case, we're going to talk about another topic that I have written about, and that is the neo-Victorian wave that's sweeping America and how our government is overreacting to it. In 1994, Jesse Temendequis raped and murdered 7-year-old Megan Conca, a neighborhood girl. 4 months later, the New Jersey legislature passed Megan's Law. And Megan's Law, that created the first publicly accessible registry of sex offenders. Since that horrible crime, sex registry laws have spread to every state. Overzealous legislators have included nonviolent offenses like public urination and flashing in the same list as violent child rapists like Temendequis. And my special guest today is Robin Vanderwall. He is a member of the board of NARSOL, that's N-A-R-S-O-L, and they are an advocate for reform or possibly abolition of these sex registry registries that have found to be far too restrictive on personal liberties. They are a challenge to our Constitution, and they're a challenge to our basic American concepts of justice. And they're having their 10th annual conference in Cleveland, Independence, actually, Ohio, near Cleveland, next weekend, June 8th to the 10th. And Robin, are you there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes. Tell me a little bit about your involvement with NARSOL. Hello?
Well,
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here. I've got a bit of an echo.
All right.
I'm not hearing it now.
Good.
I've been involved with NARSOL since it was Reform Sex Offender Laws, which was the previous name of the organization up until 2015-16. And I had done some time for a crime that I got convicted of in Virginia. And so when I was finally released, having satisfied my sentence, I wanted to find a way to get connected and get involved. And I think I may have been out 2 weeks or three and found my way to a local library. And I just began to do a search to see what was available, who was out there. And that's how I made contact with, again, at the time, Reform Sex Offender Laws, which is now NARSOL, and I've been busy doing something ever since in support of its advocacy and in support of all the folks that we're hoping to help.
Yes, and as I mentioned in when I contacted you, is a lot of our listeners are constitutional conservatives, and there is a real distinction between what we normally considered to be punishment for a crime. That is, if you commit a crime, you do your time. And most people in America agree with that. But as far as the sex registry laws, you do your time, but then you are sent out into the world, but under listed as a sex offender. Now, I understand the justification, constitutional justification for this is based on an erroneous dicta or statement by Judge Kennedy, Supreme Court Judge Kennedy, in a case in which he said that that it was a fact that sex offenders' recidivism rate is about 80%. And actually, study after study has shown that it is actually much less than that. In fact, in many or most cases, the recidivism for sex offenders is less than that for other crimes. The reason Justice Kennedy apparently based his reasoning on one article that appeared in Psychology Today, and the author has since rescinded that statement, that article, and has said he is ashamed that it's been used in so many cases to take away people's rights by putting them on these registries. Is that what you have found as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you've rehearsed it succinctly.
Okay.
That's really the history, legally speaking. At the time, the opinion you're referring to is McCune v. Lyle, which was a Supreme Court decision that occurred in 2002, and that's where the term frightening and high was first inserted into this whole line of case law that has affected or has helped to promote or propel sex offender registries as a justifiable tool of civil regulatory scheme is what it really is. At the time, there just wasn't a lot of data. There was not a lot of research about recidivism among sex offenders. There wasn't even a real clear definition of what a sex offender was. I think at that time most people had the apprehension was that most sex offenders were going to be the worst of the worst, violent rapists, extremely just despicable types of circumstances that led to convictions of certain individuals. So there was not a clear definition of sex offender. There is still not a clear definition of that, and there was no real good data. And so, yes, and Justice Kennedy, I don't want to pin too much responsibility on him, because he was simply relying upon, you know, the facts and figures that were provided to him. And I'm sure that that Psychology Today article made its way into the factual record in an honest fashion, but as you say, it has been disavowed over and again. It was not a scientific. It certainly wasn't rigorously vetted.
Okay, Robin, we have to stop for a break. We'll be back in a little while to continue our discussion, which is holding its annual convention, and NARSOL works for reform or repeal of sex registry laws. Now, Robin, I did a Google search of sorts about articles on this, and it's really amazing the things that you find just by looking at it quickly. For example, the fact that so many of these people that are convicted of these sexual crimes are teenagers, and it's I've spoken out on this show about it sometimes that some of them are involved in sexting, which is the basically playing doctor with modern technology. In other words, exchanging naked pictures of your girlfriend with your friends via the cell phones and so on. And they can be faced with distributing pornography charges and threatened with being put on the sex registry for, you know, decades or even the rest of their lives.
Well, the registry drives.
The registry drives
a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I think the registry drives a lot of that. I think a lot of the hysteria, a lot of the more the outliers is what I call them, things that really just shouldn't happen, and reasonable, rational people would easily agree that should not happen. But I think the registry is a draw, it's a magnet for law enforcement. It there's a certain excitement that goes with the idea that, oh, well, you know, we might get a conviction, but he'd be on that sex offender registry forever. We see this over and again. So that's part of the reason why NARSOL is determined to end registries, public registries altogether, is because, number one, constitutionally, we very strongly believe that it's a perpetuation of punishment well beyond a legitimate, lawful, licit sentence. And conservatives ought to agree with that. I mean, clearly, we have a constitutional republic. We have a separation of powers. And legislatures don't have the power to punish. Simple as that. And we shouldn't allow legislatures to have the power to punish. So those the fundamental constitutional reasons why we oppose it. But we also oppose it because it does appear, at least at this point, to be a self-perpetuating mechanism. And the desire to see people put on it is what's really promoting more and more, as the examples you're giving there, is sort of extreme use of it.
Yeah, that does seem kind of extreme. And not, you know, I think that most the image of a violent sex predator is normally, I would think, people that are already criminals, violent criminals, and they just happen to perform criminal acts, sexual molestation type of criminal acts. But the normal person who may make a mistake, maybe one time, is ashamed of it and does his time, does not fall into that category. But you're absolutely right. I mean, laws have a way of growing, and most people in this country don't understand how laws grow. I mean, you can pass a law that seems very reasonable on its face, but once that law is put in the hands of ambitious prosecutors, the police who like to get arrest statistics, and some judges, in fact, that also are afraid of turning somebody loose who may, in fact, commit a crime in the future, and then, you know, being accused of being too lenient, all of this gravitates or snowballs into the effect that we see today with the continuing expansion of these sex registries. Another thing I'm struck by are senior citizens. There are people that have been, thrown out of hospices, or seniors who are thrown out of apartments they've lived in for decades because some school or a daycare center opens up within 1,000 feet of where they're living. And they're just thrown out on the street because they cannot, according to the sex registry laws, they cannot live within close to one of these children's facilities.
Yeah, yeah, we have it. Yeah, it's again, it's a list issue as much as anything else. Governments, when they create lists, historically they don't do a very good job of managing lists, and they tend to perpetuate and expand them. What I'm personally fascinated by at this point is there aren't more registries. I'm very involved in reentry community, where I have a lot of conversation with folks that are coming out of prisons and people who are having challenges associated with prior criminal conviction, but certainly don't have to deal with the day-to-day of a public registry, at least not yet.
Exactly.
And that's what I keep telling them. I mean, if we got to a point, I mean, it's estimated there's some 57 million Americans with some kind of significant criminal record. Imagine waking up in a day where every one of those people and their families, because being on a registry doesn't just affect an individual, it affects everybody. It's a very much like a bill of attainder in that respect. And that it doesn't just affect the person who has to wear the label, but it affects everybody who associates with that person in dramatic ways, in palpable ways. So just imagine we woke up one day and we ended up at a point in time where it was totally justifiable, because that's the primary argument. You ask the question, why does the sex offender registry exist? Well, because in Doe's v. Connecticut Department of Public Safety, which was a case from 2003, when asked the same question, the Supreme Court said there's absolutely nothing wrong with publicizing a public fact, right? I mean, if you've been convicted of a crime, that's a public fact. The public, therefore, has a right to know that fact, and there's nothing unconstitutional about a state publicizing that fact. So it's very likely we could, in fact, end up at a point where a broad spectrum of the American population is having to deal daily with the same thing that right now only sex offenders have to deal with. But this is why it's so critical. This is why this fight is so important. Because if we don't fight this here and now and get rid of this and just dispose of it, it will expand further, and it'll be a lot larger than sex offenders.
Yeah, I think Kansas is actually registering drug offenders since a few months ago. Which is could be another trend, like you say, and it's a very disheartening. Again, the American ethic is if you do the crime, you do your time, and that should be it. And most people need rehabilitation. America has criminal justice reform is a major issue right now. We have, of
Absolutely.
Course, the Kim Kardashian speaking to Trump about nonviolent crimes and so on, but the thing is that America not only has the most people in prison per capita in the world, but we also have the longest prison sentences in the world. And so most countries realize that people that are in their 20s and do a crime, very often when those raging hormones calm down, they're no longer a threat to society. And crimes in America that can get you 40 or 50 years in a lot of other countries only get you 10 or 15. And so we need a broad-based criminal justice reform. There's no doubt about that.
We do. I think, and in order to successfully move that direction, you know, we've got to have the help of people who built this. And that's part of the issue I see, part of the problem. You mentioned the fact that your listenership is primarily of a conservative persuasion, and that's the background I came out of. I was very involved in politics and on various levels, and did a lot of work in advance of what I thought was the sort of conservative value, the conservative ideological principles that we all shared at the time. This thing does, the massive expansion of punishment and all that goes along with that, to me, that's not really reflective at all of core conservative values, especially when you consider the number of people now who are being incarcerated for minor, you know, offenses, things that aren't really that significant. And we could debate that, and that's a long debate to have. But the fact of the matter is, it is, in some sense, a conservative property that was built by the conservative constituency in the United States. And until that constituency gets really serious, there's a lot of talk. I mean, you can talk to folks who self-identify as conservative, and you can have a good, rational, reasonable discussion behind closed doors. They've got to get out in the front. They've got to get out in the public. And I'm not sure they're ready to do that, because so many of the victories and so much of the sort of the value of the movement has been built upon this appeal to the very worst part of people. And that's the desire to see others kind of, you know, get what's coming to them, which is sometimes a reasonable approach, but not always. And when it runs to excess, as it clearly has in the United States, you're right. We have far more people incarcerated. Nobody has incarcerated this many people as a proportion of their population since Rome. And
wow.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, I guess so.
Nobody. No culture on earth. And most of the time, because they can't afford it. You know, we have a luxury. We can afford this. Most countries simply could not afford, at the rate that it costs, you know, per inmate, to house a person for a full year and to feed them and to clothe them and to make sure they get proper care and bathing and medical. And it's a very expensive proposition. And there are many alternatives. But with regard to sex offenders, you're more or less presumed guilty before you even go to court. And that's a real critical problem. And in fact, NARSL's involved with a case right now, because so many sex offender cases in the United States are treated like strict liability cases, as opposed to traditional criminal, you know, cases where you have to prove what's called actus reus and mens rea, where you've got a criminal mind and you have a criminal act. Well, a lot of sex offenses don't require that. And in many states, prosecutors are walking into the door and not really having to prove any criminal intent whatsoever.
All right. Robin, we have to go for another break. And my special guest today is Robin van der Waal with NARSL. Who is fighting to eliminate the sex registry laws in the country. And Robin, before we get going, I have to give a shout out to our sponsors. Our first sponsor is Max Justice, a character who crusades for liberty and freedom against the bad guys. You can catch Max Justice on YouTube or at maxjustice.tv. And also we have a very long time sponsor, Reno Computer Services. Reno Computer Services is IT services and computer repair, routine maintenance, virus removal, data recovery. And they are an excellent operation, and you can reach them at 775-737-4400 or at www.renocomputerservices.com. Now, Robin, you were mentioning strict liability, and for those in the audience, I believe that means that it doesn't matter, like you said, what you are thinking or what you know about a particular situation. If you commit an act, that in itself is a crime. For example, if you don't know that a girl is underage, for example, that it doesn't matter. If you do something with that girl, you are held accountable even though you had no idea. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's no what's called scienter requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So a strict liability offense is similar to the speeding ticket. It doesn't matter whether you meant to go this speed or that speed, your intent. It doesn't matter if you were in a rush to get wherever. It's irrelevant. You were doing 65 in a 45, and therefore you're guilty. So we see this very often, particularly in internet-based criminal acts or sexual conduct with what might involve child pornography or images, and solicitation is a big one, where the element of one's mens rea, the idea that the person actually developed the mental intent to do some illegal sexual act, while that may be there, there may be circumstantial evidence to support it. There's no actual proof beyond a reasonable doubt being required. And there's a case right now, I believe in the Ninth Circuit, that we are involved with, where it was below, the outcome of the case below saw a federal judge decide in favor of the defendant in that case, saying that the state was not really required to prove its burden, and that this burden shifting issue is significant enough to actually be unconstitutional. So we're excited about the possibility that we might see some relief. This is a major issue. This is the Supreme Court of the United States has never really resolved that question in a clear and distinct fashion. So we're hoping that maybe that case might be a significant a victory for everybody who's charged with a crime where the state is not required to prove every element of a criminal traditional criminal offense.
So, go on.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying.
I was done with that.
Yeah. One example is the prostitution laws here in Nevada, where, a girl can look 18 and can even have ID that says she's 18. But then if you're caught in the act of in a sting or something, and you have no defense that says you actually believe that she was 18, she might be 15 or something and passing for 18. And so that is a good example of what we're talking about. And you have had some court victories, I understand. I know one of your biggest one was the laws against allowing registered sex offenders to be on social media. And that was struck down on First Amendment grounds, I believe, by the Supreme Court recently.
Yeah, that. You're referring to the Packingham case.
Yes, exactly.
That actually originated here in my home state. I'm in North Carolina.
Okay.
And that was a very, very, that was a really a huge victory for people who are forced to register, because many states have been pretty aggressive in restricting access to social media. And when you're restricted to participating in the forum, which today really is equivalent to the Roman forum, it makes it very difficult in a lot of respects. I was just having a conversation with somebody the other day who is trying to build a business and looking for various ways to expand the scope of the business, to advertise and to reach new customers, and being deprived of things like Facebook and Twitter and access to what everybody more or less takes for granted, it is very difficult because you're deprived of a utility for expansion and for scalability that everybody else can take advantage of. But you got this certain population of people who can't effectively take advantage of it. And even though we won in the Packingham case, or I should say Mr. Packingham won, but it affects everybody who's a registered sex offender, There still are restrictions that are put in place, like, for instance, Facebook. Facebook has its own corporate policy, which restricts access. Twitter has not done that. There's no reason to doubt they might at some point decide to. And then in many states, North Carolina included, even if you do decide you want to create a social account, a social media account, you have to report to the state your online identifier, you know, so the state knows who, you know, who you are. And we believe that's probably unconstitutional as well, because whenever the state knows who's speaking, the state's in a position to suppress that speech in various ways, just by virtue of the fact that it knows who the speaker is. And that's in contradiction to a line of Supreme Court cases, which has clearly established that every American has an anonymous speech right. But this particular group of Americans really do not have an anonymous speech right, not in any effectual way.
Yes.
So Pakenham was a great victory.
Okay.
And we see already how it's beginning to shape the dialogue and to shape the legal discussions that are occurring throughout the nation. We feel very good about where we're at, to be quite honest with you. We've got a long ways to go, but the federal courts certainly seem to be more concerned about this issue than they were, say, a decade ago.
Yeah, and that's good news. And you have had some other victories, I understand, but it seems to me also that when district courts in different states, for example, on the issue of whether being on a sex registry is actually a punishment or is it just a regulation, sometimes those district court decisions are overturned at the highest level in the state Supreme Courts, which is unfortunate. Is Pennsylvania still a victory for you there as far as that issue of whether it's a punishment?
It's hard to say. The Muniz, you're talking there about the Muniz decision, mm-hmm. of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, which was a very positive outcome and has certainly had a dramatic effect on the resident population there. And I know there's been at this point several thousand people who have successfully petitioned to be removed. But then the state legislature is busy at work attempting to provide a fix, and it's unclear at this point to what extent that fix might inevitably put some of the people who've been taken off back on. So it's always, you know, a victory is not enough, and this has always been the case in civil rights, in civil rights litigation. I mean, if you think about the civil rights era, which gradually expanded and brought to fruition equitable treatment of African Americans in America, in the United States. But that was a very long process. It wasn't something that took place overnight. It was incremental. And incrementalism is really kind of a very important strategic word for our movement. We can't expect that any case will be so substantial that it will simply fix all the problems related to registration and this what's called civil regulatory scheme. So our strategic approach is one that includes an incremental assessment of where do we take our best shots, and that's sort of the way we operate. We try to find places where we feel like the state is weak, and we go after the state, and we seek to win a solid victory on solid constitutional principles, and then we help build a framework and a foundation to go after the next level or to go after the next area of concern. So it's going to take a long time, but we feel very confident that we're on the right side of justice. We have no doubt about that, and we feel very confident too that in the end, we will make the use of registries in the United States a tool that might be available, but would only be available under in a strict sort of, you know, where there's a strict understanding or strict process by which a person is evaluated.
All right.
And it would be the burden of a state to determine.
Okay, and we have to come right back for our final segment. Hold on there, Robert.
Yes, sir. Okay.
How you doing, Brendan?
All right.
Difficult and delicate subject, but let me focus on one, age of consent. In every state, it's different. Nevada, it's 16, unless the girl or boy, I guess, is with an authority figure. California, it's 18. I think New York, it's 18. Some countries, I think it's 14. Some countries, it's 13. France, I understand, didn't have one. So what do we do about this? I think that this is part of the main thing. What would both of you guys like to see done as far as the age of consent? I know this is difficult, but what is your opinion on this? Since I think mostly men get in trouble, not women, but mostly men get in trouble, although, well, what's her name up there in Washington got in trouble with having sex with a 13-year-old boy. What would you like to see done? What age would you pick?
You know, it's very hard for me as a libertarian-leaning person to understand that. I think because it really almost has to be on a case-by-case basis. Some girls are sexually mature faster than others are. And, you know, as long as it's not a violent interaction, it's consensual, then there should be some leniency there. And I don't really believe in the statutory rape laws myself. I would like to see them go away, especially with, like you said, strict liability, where you may not even know that the person is underage. What do you think, Robin?
Well, I have my own thoughts, certainly, about the topic, and your caller is correct. It's a very sensitive topic, and as a result of that, NARSOL does not take a position at all. In fact, we deliberately disavow taking any position with regard to age of consent. And that's not because we don't have various individuals who are involved with our advocacy who don't have serious concerns about it. It's simply because it's not really germane to our advocacy. We're more concerned not about why people end up on registries, but about the effect of registries and the fact that we just don't believe that it should be constitutional to perpetuate punishment beyond a lawful, illicit judgment, a sentencing judgment of a court. So, I can't speak on behalf of NARSOL because we don't have a position there. All I can say is we certainly recognize that there's a lot of controversy and certainly understand that an awful lot of modern, a lot of the convictions that you see now do involve this really misunderstood and very undefined separation of ages. And the legal distinctions are vastly different from one state to the next.
Oh,
and
certainly,
we feel terrible about. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real distinction that is not found in the registries in many cases. There's no line drawn between a 50-year-old that is seduces an underage girl and a 14-year-old that has sex with his 13-year-old girlfriend that he has a relationship with. And like I said, some people mature faster than others, and that's one of the problems with the registry laws. It just doesn't make any of these distinctions on a case-by-case individual basis.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because right now, according to the best statistical evidence we have, more than a third of sexual abuse cases against minors are actually being perpetrated by people who are themselves technically minors. So there's a lot of young people's lives that are being destroyed because they're engaging in sexual activity with peers, with people relatively close in age, and yet things that I think it's fair to say have been going on culturally for quite a long while, going back decades, all of a sudden in this era these are criminal These are criminal offenses. And it's really sad to see somebody at the age of, you know, 14 or 15 or 16 getting into such enormous trouble and finding themselves either convicted of a serious crime or inevitably stuck on a registry, which is going to affect, you know, that's going to affect their entire lives going forward. It's going to diminish their capacity to find good work. It's going to diminish their capacity to get into a good school. It's enormous, the damage that the sex offender registry does to minors who are forced to be placed on one.
Yeah, and that's an argument that I've used against these drive because of the school shootings, which are still an infinitesimally small number of students compared to the total number of students in schools that are affected by these heinous shootings. But the drive to have school resource officers put in just about every school and introducing that police mentality, which you know, we see example after example of how they do, in fact, charge these children with this, or threaten to charge them with these crimes for not even touching each other, but passing along, like I say, the photos of each other to their friends, which is nothing more than spin the bottle or playing doctor with modern technology.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, getting back to the registry, though, the question I think that's essential is it effective? Is it an effective tool of public policy for making people safe? And we see more and more studies not only suggesting that it is totally not effective tool at all, it is not making the public safer, but in some instances, there's actually evidence that it might be making the public less safe. And the rationale behind that in those studies is because you have a population of people who are depressed, not depressed mentally, but I'm saying depressed in their opportunities to reintegrate, to get good jobs, and to function socially. They're sort of living underground, and they're we see more evidence now of the sex offender population in the United States turning to the types of crime that are, you know, really not very helpful, not very good for the safety of the community, just in order to survive, just in order to get by. So, you know, registries have not proven to accomplish the goals that were set out initially for them to accomplish. Not only that, to me, the most important fact is that on any given day in the United States, well more than 95% of the sex offenses that will occur that day are not perpetrated by anybody who's on a registry. So it's not as if the registry as a tool has done anything to reduce the rate of first offenses. You know, sex offenses continue to happen at a pretty stable rate, and that's nothing to be proud about, but it is a reason to think whether or not we're actually concentrating public resources on the right tool. Because I believe everybody would like to see a reduction in the rate of sex offenses, and we're not putting our money into the types of mechanisms and the types of public policy that are going to effectively accomplish that goal. And the sex offender registry is just this gigantic kind of sidebar that makes people feel good, but doesn't accomplish any of the goals that were set for it.
Yeah, and Robin, here in Nevada, we have a bit of a controversy going on because the Democrat the primaries are coming up, and one of the Democratic candidates, Chris Conguiciani, is a staunch defender of the teachers' unions and the public schools. Chris G, she's called, and she's in stirring up a bit of a controversy because when the sex registry laws were being put into effect in Nevada, she tried to carve out an exemption for teachers. And eventually, though, in 2015, that carve-out was abolished. But, you know, the idea that you shouldn't be political favoritism would be a a cause of this, and that people in public office or people that have jobs in the public sector would not be subject to these laws is pretty offensive, and I wish we could get around to actually attacking the and rescinding the sex registry laws themselves instead of playing politics with them.
Well, I agree with you, but that's I think legislatively that's going to be virtually impossible, in my opinion. So we're going to have to continue to hold the legislatures to feet to the fire through litigation, mm-hmm. and gradually over time, hopefully denude them of this public policy option by making it too costly.
And then we almost had a reform a couple of sessions ago that would allow teenagers with clear and convincing evidence to escape the sex registry, and it was passed in the legislature, but then vetoed by the governor. For those who are interested in following up on this, you have an excellent website, narsol.org, narsol.org, and there are a lot of resources there. Like you say, the number of new studies that are coming out, law review articles, is really impressive. And if anybody wants to do further research on this, I would suggest they visit that website. And also, the 10th Annual Conference for NARSOL is coming up this next weekend, June 8th to 10th, in Independence, Ohio. And you can find out more about that on the conference.narsol.org. Have a good day, Mr. Robin. It was great talking to you.